The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, producer and editor here in the library's author events office, and I'm very excited to be here tonight to introduce Jane Brox. Jane Brox's book, 5,000 Days, like this one, An American Family History, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award in Nonfiction. She is also the author of Here and Nowhere Else, Late Seasons of a Farm and Its Family, winner of the L.L. Winship Penn New England Award. She is also the author of Clearing Land, Legacies of the American Farm, and Brilliant, The Evolution of Artificial Light, named one of 2010's best books by Time Magazine. Spanning from the caves at Lascaux to the invention of the light bulb and beyond, Brilliant was referred to in a glowing review in The Guardian as haunting, thoroughly engrossing, and beautifully written. Tonight's author's essays have been widely anthologized in such volumes as Best American Essays, The Norton Book of Nature Writing, and the Pushcart Prize Anthology, and she has earned grants from such institutions as the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Massachusetts Cultural Council. A former professor at Harvard University and Bowdoin College, Brox currently serves on the faculty of Lesley University's MFA program. Her new book is called Silence, A Social History of One of the Least Understood Elements of Our Lives. Told through the oddly but intrinsically linked histories of the monastery and the penitentiary, including a section on Philadelphia's own beloved but beholden to a sometimes sinister history, Eastern State Penitentiary, Silence maps the complex ways this heretofore largely unexplored but fundamental concept has influenced our notions of the self, the soul, and the larger societies that we build and share. So without further ado, Philadelphia, let's for a moment practice the opposite of silence as we welcome Jane Brox to the Free Library.
Thank you, thanks. It's a real pleasure to be back in Philadelphia. I came down here three times to visit Eastern State Penitentiary over the years I was writing the book. But it wasn't only the visits to the penitentiary, it was the book, that my idea for the book started in 2001 with a visit to a monastery, the Monastery of Senanc in southern France. But I really didn't understand how I was going to, I felt I needed something more around which to cohere a book. And that didn't happen until at least 10 years later when I by chance came to Eastern State Penitentiary and walked through the stabilized ruin and saw the mock-up of the original cell with the barreled ceiling and the 8-inch oculus cut into the ceiling. And it really then solidified for me an idea of a book that could oscillate between the penitentiary and the monastery and talk about these two very distinct means of silence, the chosen and the imposed, and not only how they were opposite, but how they might inform each other and bleed into one another. So I think of Philadelphia and Eastern State Penitentiary as very integral to the whole process of my writing this book. And as some of you may know, Eastern State Penitentiary was the first formed right after the founding of the country with Benjamin Rush looking for an idea for a new kind of justice to replace the blood punishments. And he came up with the idea of the penitentiary with the hope that the kind of monastic silence and solitude would lead ultimately to redemption. And although 1829, the year the penitentiary was opened, was years after Benjamin Rush's death, his ideas really were at the foundation of starting the penitentiary. So tonight, I thought, being in Philadelphia and being very near the penitentiary, I would start the reading with just reading a description of the first prisoner's experience in that cell, and the kind of silence he was unwittingly being subjected to then. The first prisoner was a young black man named Charles Williams. The first prisoner to arrive at Eastern State, Charles Williams, an 18-year-old black farmer who could read and who bore a scar on the bridge of his nose and another from a dirk on his thigh. For breaking into a house and stealing a silver watch, a gold seal, and a gold key worth in total $25, he was sentenced to 2 years of solitary and silent confinement. What did he imagine as he was transported through the countryside from the Delaware County Jail on October 25th, 1829? The horses' hooves raised the old dust of the season, the wagon wheels creaked, the late birds called as he breathed in the last open life he would know for 2 years. After he passed through the penitentiary gate, a ritual to prepare him for his cell began. It was almost as elaborate as that required of a postulant entering a monastery. He took off his street clothes, was given a bath, and had his hair cut short. He was examined by a physician, and his scars were noted. He was issued 2 handkerchiefs, 2 pairs of socks, 1 pair of shoes, trousers, a jacket, and a shirt. His identity as prisoner number 1 would be sewn into his clothing and hung above the entrance to his cell. He was not to be called Charles again for the duration of his stay. He wouldn't be able to receive or write letters, although he might exchange occasional words with a guard or inspector, and he would receive regular visits from moral and spiritual instructors. No friends or family would be allowed to visit him. He was not to talk unless instructed to. He was not to make any unnecessary noise. He'd be almost totally cut off from modern speech and its ancient history, and would hear no more than small scurryings in the walls or the sighs of his own making. Although 9 other prisoners would be admitted in those first months of the penitentiary, everyday criminals like himself, horse thieves and highway robbers, Charles Williams would not know whether he lived among 9 or 90. While each prisoner was being escorted to his cell, he was hooded both to shield him from seeing others and to disorient him within the penitentiary. Not only would he not know his fellow prisoners, but he was never to know where in the compound his cell was located. Nor would he be allowed to leave it except in sickness or during an emergency. When William's hood was lifted, he stood on a stone floor, a sole wrapped in rough cloth and surrounded by a 12-by-8-foot whitewashed cell containing an iron bed, a straw mattress, a sheet, a blanket, some scrubbing and sweeping brushes, a clothes rail, a wash basin, a mirror, a crude flush toilet, a tin cup, a victuals plan, a stool, and a workbench where he was to spend his time making shoes. There would be coffee and cocoa in the morning, a ration of 1 pound of bread a day, potatoes and meat at noon, Indian mush in the evening, 1/2 gallon of molasses a month. He could ask for salt. He'd be given vinegar as a favor. Come Christmas, he'd receive 1 pound of pork, potatoes, and an apple. Other than during his daily hour of exercise, the sun in all its seasons would be restricted to what glinted through the iron lattice door to his exercise yard when the exterior door hadn't been secured, or what shone down from the 8-inch circular window cut into the barreled ceiling. Enough light by which to read the New Testament. It said the window came to be known as the Eye of God, though the architect called it a dead eye, and it could be darkened by covering it with 1/2 cask should a prisoner need to be disciplined. Darkening a cell meant a prisoner also lost his only means of measuring the days. As long as the sun wasn't taken from him, he could concentrate on what light was granted to him. Though he could not orient himself in space, he could orient himself in time. British writer and social theorist Harriet Martineau, who visited Eastern State in the mid-1830s, wrote, I never met with one who could in the least tell me what the form of the central part of the prison was, or which of the radii his cell was placed in, though they make very accurate observations of the times at which the sun shines in. It was hoped there would be an expansiveness in the silence, and in the sunlight squeezing through the small aperture, casting undistracted shadows on the whitewashed walls. Charles Williams' sentence was meant to punish him for his crimes and deter others from committing the same, but it was also meant to alter his soul. I already hear the inhabitants of our villages and townships counting the years that shall complete the reformation of one of their citizens, proclaimed Benjamin Rush. I behold them running to meet him on the day of his deliverance. His friends and family bathe his cheeks with tears of joy, and the universal shout of the neighborhood is, "This, our brother, was lost and is found, was dead and is alive." I tried to imagine Williams there, lumpen in his official clothing, disoriented, unseen, in the prickling silence he woke to and slept to, sometimes read in. His thoughts roamed in it, the small sounds of his work as a shoemaker accompanied it, the limit of his world, where he ate and slept and dreamed and worked and took the air, was narrower than the recommended space for a cherry tree. So that's a description of what Charles Williams encountered. And it's worth noting that the Eastern State Penitentiary, although it's in the middle of Philadelphia now, and if you see an aerial shot, you see the neighborhood just making its way around it as if it were a stone in the stream, was 3 miles outside of the city when it was built in 1829. And it was built on an old farm, and specifically in the cherry orchard, so it was often called Cherry Hill because of that. And Benjamin Rush's idea, I think, was well-meaning, but in fact, it was the very opposite of the idea behind monastic silence, because in a monastery, the idea of community is at the very center of the silence. The idea, and the days are filled with the human voice in song. The men or the women in work together, pray together, take meals together, even though the meals are in silence. In the penitentiary, there were a lot of forces working to create the penitentiary, not just Benjamin Rush's own idea, but he was influenced by a lot of the Enlightenment ideas about reform at the time, and some of them being that in the old jails of the time, which were very chaotic, the older, experienced prisoners were corrupting the younger misdemeanants who they were in jail with, so that the idea of separating the prisoners and keeping them distinct from one another had to do with keeping the bad influences away from them. But in fact, taken to the extreme, created not an external chaos, as you would have found in the old jails of the colonial time, but internal chaos within each prisoner. Many of the prisoners suffered psychologically from their internment, as you could guess. It was very difficult to conjure the world of Charles Williams. He left no writings himself. All I had to glean of his specific experience came from the record books from Eastern State Penitentiary and the records of visitors who came and talked to Charles Williams and interviewed him over the 2 years he was in the prison. And I couldn't find no record of what he did upon his release from prison after 2 years to the day. He just disappeared into the world with his skills as a shoemaker. But I used over time the experiences of other people in solitary confinement, even into the 20th century, in the Soviet gulags, in the Soviet Union, for example. Because the experience of solitary confinement shared consistencies throughout time. When it came to writing about the monastery, I had the opposite problem in a way, because I turned to Thomas Merton, who had journals, notebooks, all kinds of writings about his monastic experience. And the challenge was not to draw out of meager records a world, but to carve out of a plethora of words a story of the monastic experience. And I did not only depend on Merton, but he, in fact, becomes the counterpart to Charles Williams in the book. He becomes the monastic soul that we follow through the book. And I just want to read, to give you a little counterweight from the heaviness of the Eastern state, a little bit of a chapter from the monastic segment of the book. I'll say first that the book was, one of the great challenges of the book was how to structure it, because in fact I couldn't structure it the way I structured my previous book, Brilliant, which was a march through time. I had to figure out, this is more a meditative journey, and it to some extent switches from dark to light, dark to light, but I wanted intentionally almost to structure it like a poem so that some of the elements of the penitentiary would thread through the monastic segments and some of the monastic material would thread through the penitentiary segments so that they weren't entirely distinct from one another, because they do inform one another, and I hoped the reading experience would somehow reflect that. But this is from a chapter called Speech and Silence. And in this chapter, I talk a bit about what actually speaking in the monastery meant and the significance of the voice in the monastery. And what of simple talk within such a prescribed world of voices and silence? It's meant to be rare, and during medieval times was nearly as regulated as it would be at Eastern state. Although the restriction on speech for contemplative monastics during the Middle Ages wasn't absolute, it was formal. Cistercians, who are a hermetic order from the early Middle Ages and live to this day as both Cistercians and Trappists, Thomas Merton was a Trappist monk. During the middle, restriction on speech for contemplative monastics during the Middle Ages wasn't absolute, but it was formal. Cistercians were limited as to when, where, and about what they spoke. And speaking was to be used with discipline, most often by monks in specialized positions, such as the abbot, the cellarer, the porter, and the master of the novices. They were required, after all, to conduct the business of the abbey, procure supplies, take care of guests, or teach. To this day, obedience is a given in the conversations that do take place between a monk and a superior, students and teachers, confessor and priest. The master should speak and teach, notes Benedict. That's Benedict of Nursia, whose rule guides monastic life to this day. It's a 6th century rule. The disciple should quietly listen and learn. No matter what must be asked of the superior, it must be done with humility and reverent submission. Such obedience and conversation can't help but seem strange and constricting now, but there is an implied dignity in it, a devotion to the depth and true import of human speech, for the root meaning of the verb obey establishes just how essential silence is to speech. The word is from the Latin obedere. To obey is to be subject to serve, to pay attention to give ear, to listen to perceive. To listen fully requires silence. To engage in meaningful conversation requires silence. Speech and silence belong together, observed 20th century Swiss philosopher Max Picard. To see speech without silence is like seeing Shakespeare's fools without the solidity of Shakespeare's heroes. I think 6 years of research was worth coming across that quote. I love it. So, the silence in which a speaker pauses to think, to choose the right word, the silence in which another listens is a sign of respect that allows time to comprehend the weight and meaning of what is said. That affirms the import of language itself. Also, the silence to which a speaker turns an attentive ear after her last word rises. Listening requires that I come out of myself so as to make room for speech, wrote French philosopher Jean-Louis Chrétien. It is a listening that is freed from everything sticky and clinging in its psychological representations, a listening without glue, a listening that is free and liberating. In his rule, Benedict specifically warns against the most breathless kind of talk, murmuring, gossip, and grumbling, which he groups with stubbornness, disobedience, pride, and joking. It is not only that gossip is almost void of silence even when quietly whispered in another's ear, consider its synonyms, hearsay, chit-chat, scuttlebutt. Gossip also suggests a loose or ungoverned tongue. If monks, believing themselves created in the image of the divine, spent their voices on gossip, they'd undercut their efforts to prove worthy of God. More than a dozen centuries after Benedict, Thomas Merton instructed his scholars, silence itself is a human value. He explained further, restraint from useless words has a human value. But just as speech has its degrees of integrity, so does silence, which can become an unthinking exercise or an excuse for non-involvement. Silence can lie as well as words, and to listen to one another can at times be far more difficult than listening to the large silence of the world. In the end, there is nothing less narrow than human speech, distinguishing and various. And a silence practiced too simply, too much for its own end, is not silence so much as muteness, which isn't really a synonym for silence. The two words exclude one another, wrote Italian philosopher Michele Federico Sciacca in the 1950s. Silence is a kind of communication. What is mute isolates and cuts off from all communication. Rather than being a lack on the sense level, silence is an intensification on the spiritual level. The monastery, with its own distinct and elaborate silence, with its particular regulations, possesses no less danger of distorted silence than does secular life. It can be as restrictive as the imposed silence of the penitentiary. Sister Joanne Otenstreuer, a Dominican nun writing in the late 1960s, suggested that silent monastic meals might be a lost opportunity for deeper human communication, that speaking at mealtime could offer something essential to the community. And she says, an appreciation and respect for the kind of communication which builds real personal relationship and thus a community of united persons must be developed in order to make silence a purposeful rather than a destructive force. Possibly the effort required to develop good table conversation would require much more self-discipline and unselfishness than keeping silence. And although the silence is less rigid in a contemporary monastery, it may seem more emphatic, for the monastic traditions rose to prominence in a quieter time than our own. Though men and women could certainly be talkative in the Middle Ages, they likely spoke more slowly, and the silences between words were more pronounced. Do they not talk and think faster in the depot than they did in the stage office? Henry David Thoreau asked nearly two centuries ago. The speed of talk has only increased in the ensuing centuries, and now actual voices jostle with recorded and transmitted voices for attention. Perhaps because monastic silence exists outside of the usual course of human life and social norms, its powers and presumptions are that much more easily distorted. At Gethsemane, Merton discovered that finding the right silence seemed at times far more difficult than finding the right words. What a disaster to build the contemplative life on the negation of communication, he wrote. That is what, in fact, our silence often is, because we are obscuring it without really wanting it, yet needing it nonetheless, and without understanding what it is all about. And then he writes, that is why there is so much noise in a Trappist monastery, the infernal clatter and hullabaloo, the continual roar of machinery, the crash of objects falling from the hands of distraught contemplatives. All this protests that we hate silence with all our power, because with our wrong motives for seeking it, it is ruining our lives. Yet the fact remains that silence is our life, but a silence which is communication and better communication than words. If only someone could tell us how to find it. The worst pity of all is that we think we know. What we have found is our own noise. No, that is not true. The paradox is that in spite of all, we have found God, and that is probably the trouble. Such a discovery is altogether too much, and we beat a hasty retreat into any kind of protection. And then Merton later went on to say, Babel, silence not a virtue, noise not a sin. It's an observation that applies equally to the penitentiary and the monastery, both institutions born of human imagination and subject to human frailties. More specifically, Merton wrote, but if silence itself becomes the worship of a concept, then we become prisoners of what we are seeking to escape. And then we judge like the workers in the vineyard and make our tyrannical concept the measure of everything that happens under the sun. And I thought I would just end before the question period by returning to the penitentiary. The book begins with my wandering through the penitentiary, and there's a coda at the end of the book where I take in the time, so I run through the time after Charles Williams and what happened to the penitentiary and its inmates in the ensuing centuries. And I'll just read a few pages of that. Strangely, the penitentiary stands more stable in its afterlife than it did as a working prison. It began to change almost as soon as it opened on that October day in 1829 when Charles Williams arrived, for it soon became apparent that there would not be adequate space to accommodate all the prisoners to come. So John Haviland, who was the architect, altered his dream of symmetry to include upper floors on the unbuilt ranges, each with an extra room to compensate for the lack of an outdoor exercise yard. His original plan would house fewer than 300. Once it was finally completed in 1844, it could house 586. Even so, in the aftermath of the Civil War, the demand for cells outgrew even the added space, and the warden had no choice but to double up prisoners in the cells. There is a photograph from the later decades of the 19th century showing two men in one cell, each at work at his cobbler's bench. They are facing each other, though their heads are bent to their tasks. In the 12-by-8-foot room, among the shoes and shoe lasts, the leather and cords, a rocking chair, a small pile of books, a model schooner, pictures on the walls, hanging lace adorning a shelf. Yet the official practice of silent and separate incarceration didn't end until 1913, when Eastern State converted to a congregate system of incarceration and strict silence was no longer formally enforced. Prison authorities then squeezed in more cell blocks constructed of reinforced concrete and built communal areas, mostly where Haviland's exercise yards had stood, a long, narrow dining hall, workrooms, a chapel, a synagogue. They fashioned a large outdoor exercise space. But the world built for isolation was never really suited for a communal prison and could not be satisfactorily reconfigured. The cells were small. No renovation could create adequate common space. Prisoners and officials continued to struggle with overcrowding. In its jerry-rigged state, the old penitentiary functioned as a congregate prison for more than half a century, during which time it published its own magazine. The inmates played chess with each other and formed singing clubs. They watched movies together and eventually television. Brief silent films show prisoners playing football or standing in groups in the open or sitting together atop the walls of the same exercise yards that once kept Charles Williams and his contemporaries from seeing one another. Their legs dangle from the tops of the walls as they cheer on boxing matches on the prison grounds. Even before Eastern State closed in 1970 and the remaining inmates were transferred to another state prison, there had been discussions regarding what to do with the 10 acres that by then stood in the middle of Philadelphia. The land had extraordinary value, but the penitentiary had been designed as a fortress. Its walls and structures would be prohibitively expensive to demolish. So once it closed, the prison stood abandoned for decades, while ideas for preservation or redevelopment were proposed and defeated time and again. A shopping center, an industrial park, residences, create a monument to Eastern State, but by demolishing all but one wing, tear down everything and create a park. By 1987, less than two decades after the last prisoners at Eastern State left on the last bus, what was left to preserve had become its own question. A good part of John Haviland's early 19th century design had long been obscured by subsequent renovations, and once all care was abandoned, the fate of the penitentiary seemed, in some respects, not much different from that of a neglected cherry orchard. Trees between the ranges overtopped the roofs, a colony of feral cats thrived. Weed seeds blew into old exercise yards and took hold. They flourished, and then their seed heads dried and scattered. The remnants of Haviland's design and all the renovations that succeeded it were subject to the same wind and rain, though they were not all equal in their disintegration. One engineer who visited the decaying penitentiary suggested that the forces of nature represented the construction history played in reverse. Those buildings and building systems added most recently were proving to be the least durable and were in the most advanced state of deterioration, followed by those of the early 20th century and then of the late 19th, with the likelihood being that the process would leave, in the end, only the Haviland work remaining. And I think I'll stop there and take questions if you have them. Thank you very much.
Thank you. What interested you particularly about the idea of silence as a topic?
I think, you know, I had spent in my early 20s, I had spent a winter at the edge of Nantucket Island, and I was house sitting all by myself on a dirt road, and I realized the silence almost drove me crazy. And I would light a huge fire every night. I had almost no radio. There was no one else on the road. I don't know why I had agreed to do this. But I, you know, the silence and the darkness became these profound and animate things there. And I had thought I had safely put all that behind me until, you know, almost a quarter of a century later, I went to the monastery in the south of France. And I visited these rooms built for silence, and it was the peace within them and the sense of space and order that was so different from my own chaotic experience of silence that started me wanting to write something about it. But it wasn't until I came to Philadelphia 10 years after that and went to Eastern State that I really understood how I might structure a book on silence. I still don't quite fully understand it, but that's the story I've created for myself, I suppose.
Thank you for being here. So do you think if you went back to a winter house on Nantucket now, you would have, also with your life experience since then, like you would have a different relationship with that place?
Oh, I do. And in fact, when I moved to Maine, which is very much, the weather is very much Maine, very much like Maine here today. When I moved to Maine, I spent my first winter house sitting on a tidal river. You know, it was less isolated than Nantucket, but I loved it. And I just loved the sense, the silence and the space there. And I think I was far more mature, and I was more certain of my life. The thing about that winter on Nantucket is I didn't know what I was doing with my life. I wanted to be a writer. I didn't understand how to be a writer. So there were all those internal questions roiling around in the silence as well. So it's interesting to have had that second experience when I was almost 50. To counterbalance that earlier experience. Yeah. I mean, even though Nantucket almost drove me crazy, I wouldn't trade it for anything. So, all right. Yes.
when you took the trip to France and visited the monastery, was there a thought with sort of revisiting your experience in Nantucket, or was it sort of a completely different thread that brought you there?
It was. I had no idea. I was with a friend who said, who told me we were going to a monastery that day, and I had known nothing about it, and we just drove down this valley into this beautiful a monastery sitting like the in the center of this valley, and it wasn't. I mean, it couldn't. It, you know, there were other people milling around. It could never be the same, and it wasn't an enduring experience like Nantucket. And it was a profoundly different kind of silence than I had experienced, and it felt profoundly peaceful. And the other mystery that happened, we went back that night to Vespers, and I write about this in the book, is... you know, I was listening to the monks and nuns chanting and singing through the service, but the most moving moment of the service was this brief interval of silence between the singing. And I don't even understand what happened, but in that silence, this huge emotion welled up. And I think maybe writing the book was trying to understand what happened in that moment even. And I still don't understand that.
Are you familiar with the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius? It's with the Jesuits. It has something to do, it's a week-long, maybe a month-long period where I think it's centered around silence. I've never done it, but from what I understand people have done, it's quite profound.
Yes, I'm familiar with it. I myself have never done it. I haven't allowed myself. I won't say, because it's a choice we all make, and I haven't allowed myself that time and commitment to do that, but I have heard of it, yeah. The centering silence, yeah.
I really enjoyed your readings, they're still kind of washing over me, like I'm trying to form a question out of it, but I really enjoyed the cadence of them. It was almost like your reading was filled with silence in a strange, strange way. But one of the things that struck me, particularly in the monastic setting, was there seems to be this very articulate awareness of kind of like the tyranny of imposed silence. Like they seem to have this way of getting at how they were almost like fighting it in some sense. I don't know. It's the difference between, I guess, longing for the natural silence that's out there, or just finding ways to be quieter in the world, versus this is the deal here, or this is the rule of this particular place. And they seem very articulate about the struggle. It just struck me in a number of the people whose voices you used. In other words, you were quoting them. They seem to capture that rebellion in some way.
Yeah. I mean, for them, silence is in no way passive. It's a very active silence, and from what I understand, they're seeking something within the silence. So that, and it's never stable. So you can imagine centering your life on a silence that is neither passive nor stable, and how what the stakes are in that. I think what the stakes are for. I will say I visited several monasteries. I visited a Trappistine, a group of nuns in Wrentham, Massachusetts, and I was able to talk for an hour with one of the nuns about silence. She was the most secure person I think I've ever encountered. It was really profound, and just how articulate she was about silence, and how she grew into it, and how she saw the postulants coming into the monastery growing into it. With it, you know, the young woman would come in and be very anxious or kind of jittery in the silence, and then gradually they would find a sense of peace within it. I think not all of them, you know, I'm sure not everybody succeeded in dedicating their life to it, but so.
Everything you've said has brought up a whole bunch of ideas for me, but one of the lines that was almost an aside was about the difference between muteness and silence. And I'm sorry, and I just wondered if you have anything more you could add to that distinction.
Well, I mean, I think muteness, to me, always seems like something that's very straightforward. It's not talking. You're mute. And silence, there's a beautiful book, and I would recommend it to anyone. I have some questions about it, but it's called The World of Silence by Max Picard, and I refer to it frequently in here. And he talks about silence as an entity in the world. And he talks about there is no synonym for what he means by silence. It is its own entity. And for instance, he says, the radio has destroyed silence because it allows no space for silence anymore. That the radio continues even after it's turned off because it's in our minds, and we have this expectation that the radio is always going to be there to counter silence. And he talks about the profundity of living in a world where silence is its own entity. So silence to him is a much bigger concept than muteness. Does that answer your question a little bit? Yeah. I mean, I find, for me, this book hasn't given me answers about silence, I think, at all. I think it's made my understanding of silence more complicated and more complex, and that I don't think I'm looking to provide answers with the book, but only to ask more questions, maybe, as Thomas Merton would say. Yeah.
The people that live outside the monastery, the ordinary people,
How
do they regard the monastery? Is there any type of relationship? Do they provide clothing, or what is there any, and how, or are the monasteries also geographically isolated?
Well, are you speaking of a contemporary monastery?
Yes.
So, for instance, it was interesting, the Mount St. Mary's in Wrentham, I think when it was built in the 1940s, was very much in a rural area, and now suburbia has washed right up to its edges. But when I went, I would go to the liturgical services throughout the day, Lauds, Prime. And you can sit there and watch the nuns perform the service. And there would always be, except for the one vigils, which is at 3 a.m, where I was the only one there, there would always be people from the community there watching. I think that it's a very, monasteries now are vestigial. You know, they're very much hidden within our larger society. I don't think there are more than 4,000 Cistercian monks in the world, and most of the monasteries are no longer functioning. In the Middle Ages, there were hundreds upon hundreds of monasteries just in Europe. But I think where they thrive, there is an exchange. You know, the people from the town come to Mass at the monastery. The sisters, Cistercians are required to, at least in part, pay their own way. So the sisters at Mount St. Mary's have a chocolate factory, and they make chocolates and sell chocolates online and in their store. So there is an exchange with the world, and they are available for counseling. And that's how, you know, you can go to the monastery and ask to speak to one of the sisters if you have spiritual questions or something like that. So they're not, you know, I think it's a misconception. They don't take a vow of silence. That's not one of their solemn vows. They lead largely silent lives, and they don't talk at all after the last service, Compline. It's called the Great Silence during the night until vigils and 3 a.m. That's an unbroken time of silence. But they do, and in a modern monastery, they'll also talk with each other at times. So it's much more active, I think, than is commonly believed. That was one of the other things I was interested in doing in a book, teasing out the complexity of that life, that it's not entirely remote.
I'm sure you're familiar with the French film Into Great Silence.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. The Trappistine monks in the high in the French Alps.
That was in the... They're actually more hermetic than the Trappistines. Those are the They're the monks of the Grand Chartreuse, right? Yeah, and outside of Grenoble. Yeah. It's really an astonishing film, and it's almost 3 hours long, and I could feel the silence in my own house while I was watching it. Yeah, I would recommend that too. Thank you. Thank you for bringing it up. Yeah. Well, okay. Thank you all. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.